Coming up today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, his family told him to flee across the border into Mexico and avoid the draft. But instead, he served proudly as a paratrooper and took part in the largest single-day airborne assault in history.
By the time we hit the ground, our bullets go in all directions.
Hear about how he made it through all of that and about the sentimental journey he'll be taking next month. Don't miss it today at 1 on News Talk 580, brought to you by Humana. Proud to honor our hometown heroes.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show where each time we take a trip back in time and listen to stories from members of our greatest generation. Today, we're going to visit with a 92-year-old paratrooper from Lemoore, California, Julian Mazuca, 92 years old, like I said, not originally from California. He grew up in Texas. Uvalde, Texas? Where in the world is that?
Between Del Rio and San Antonio. 80 miles from south of San Antonio, and that's where Uvalde is.
And you grew up in a big Mexican-American family?
Yes. Two brothers and four sisters.
And where were you in that group of seven?
I got a sister older than me. Uh-huh. I'm the second one in the family.
So you're the oldest boy and the second of all of them. What was it like growing up there in Texas? What kinds of things did you do as a kid?
My father used to work on a ranch. Different places, but he was a professional chip chair. And when we grew up, that's where we learned how to do chairing, and I do that for 45 years in this town here. Mm-hmm. I was in charge of the crew. I had a crew working for me for 45 years.
We'll take a brief aside down that path then. What's the key to being good at shearing sheep? Do you pick up a touch for shearing sheep so you don't spook them? Or what's the secret to doing it right?
I grew up in that environment, so I learned that kind of it. And for me, it was easy because that's what I do almost. And that's what when I get out of the service, I started a crew on my own. And I stayed here for 45 years, and I quit in 1991.
What's the worst thing that ever happened to you while shearing sheep? I'm sure not every single sheep was cooperative.
Well, I was a relative chief chair for not very long. I used to, in charge of the crew, all of the employers, they were my employers. Uh-huh. I started that business myself. I buy the equipment and everything, and I do the contracting.
So you laugh at them when the sheep runs away from them.
Yeah. All of those contracting check and pay the guys and tell them what to do.
A pretty big territory that you covered shearing sheep?
Prairie Valley. All the way up to Oregon.
Wow.
Chair almost 240,000 to 250,000.
Wow.
In 3.5 months.
That's a lot of sheep. That's a lot of wool. And that was an important enough job that actually got you some deferments. We'll talk about that. But I like to ask every veteran what he remembers about December 7th, 1941. Do you remember how you found out that the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor?
I remember that very well. I was in Arizona working in the ranch or someplace, and I remember well.
What did it mean to you as a young man? You were just 20 years old at the time.
I don't know what to say. What I mean, I know it's not very good.
Did it occur to you at all that what was starting to happen might involve you at some point, that you might have to do something?
Yeah, I know that. And that's when I registered for the service. And I had a different name. I don't know. My name was Julian Mazuca. They used to call me Pedro. And when I went to register for the service, they had to take my birth certificate. And there was Julian. And I asked my mother, how come they call me Pedro and my real name is Julian? I said, your grandma changed your name because you look like your grandfather.
So they've been lying to you all those years?
For a long, long time. And from then on, I know that I had to use my right name, Julian, and that's what I used my right name.
So all your buddies in the war certainly called you by that name. But you didn't go right away. How many deferments did you get and why?
Three.
Yeah.
3 days for him because I was chip churning and I got a chance to 6 months in each deform. And after 3 deforms is no more, they called me for to go on for my physical. And the next day, I mean the same day, they called me and I wasn't there at 11 o'clock, giving the papers, put me in the train to San Pedro, to Los Angeles, and they picked me up in San Pedro, in Los Angeles, take me to San Pedro. And they put uniform on me.
Going to San Pedro is almost enough to make you want to change your name back to Pedro.
Yeah. Almost. Yeah.
I know it was a long time ago, but what do you think your expectations were about going in the Army? Because by this time, February of 1944, there's a lot that's been happening. You've probably heard about some of this war overseas.
Well, I was not afraid to. I was willing to go and do my service. I had a lot of offers to go to Mexico and forget about going to service. I said, no, I'll stay here. And if the rest of the guys go, I go. And that's where I went. And you know, to be a paratrooper, that's a big commandment. You have to raise your right hand and you said, they asked if you're willing to jump any place, any time to defend your country. And I said, yes, I do. And that's what they put the wings on after you qualify, make 5 jumps.
Before we get to any of your jumps, I want to find out how you ended up being a paratrooper, because most guys don't get drafted and get stuck in that. You probably had to volunteer somewhere. Had you ever been in an airplane before?
No, I never been in an airplane. And that's a guy, we was in a basic training in Little Rock, Arkansas. A couple of weeks before we finished the training, they takes to the theater and show how they want to volunteer for paratroopers. And the guy, there was my friend who stayed in the same barracks. His name is Tony Maris. He said, let's go and be signed for paratroopers. I said, no, I don't say, yeah, I got the guts. We got the guts too.
That must have been a good movie.
So we signed up, and about a week later, they called us for another physical. And he didn't pass the physical, and I do.
So he pulled a fast one on you. He's the one who got you to volunteer, and he didn't have to do it, huh?
Yeah, so.
Did you stay in touch with him at all? Do you know what he ended up doing?
Well, he's in L.A., but I don't know. His name is Tony Maris. And one time I went to the parade, to the Rose Parade, and I meet him. I seen him in the street, went by. By the time I parked my car, he disappeared.
They showed you guys a movie about what paratroopers do.
With 751 paratroopers went for training. Out of the 751, the only guy, 111, got the win. The rest of the old, they didn't make it.
So you trained with 750 other guys, but only 111 of you made it?
That's right.
How tough was it? What weeded so many guys out?
Well, it's kind of tough. And they raised you up in those towers, 250 feet up in the air. And you had to do all the instruction. They get do this and do that. And then I said, click, and here come 35 feet, like it's going to hit the floor. And boy, that take the cake. That's the toughest. Jumping in an iron place is nothing to it. But those towers, they're something else.
Yeah, I hope you weren't afraid of heights.
After you go 2-3 times, it's nothing to it. I mean, when you get down, the lieutenant would say, ask you what your name, and then you have to give your name, the social security, and all that. But I can't even talk. He hits you in the back. He said, you have to control your nerves, Julian. He said, you have to know how to control your nerves. And that's true.
I guess you developed that over time. What did your family say when you told them you were a paratrooper?
This is up to me. This is up to me, but they don't want me to be in the service the first time. They want me to go to Mexico, and they're going to help me put some kind of a business and stay there. I said, no.
They were doing that because they didn't want you to die. I mean, that's what it was, right?
Yes, right. Same my life, but I'm glad I do what I think was right.
Well, I think all our listeners would agree, and I think it took some courage, clearly, to make that decision, too. You mentioned those jump towers, and they're actually still there at Fort Benning, where our paratroopers train today. They were originally made as part of a thrill ride for the 1939 World's Fair in New York City, 255 feet and 6 inches high. I've got photos of them on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. They have 4 horizontal arms, like a big X or a plus sign at the top of that tower, and they take you out to the end of that arm on a cable, and then let you go, right?
And you have to give all instructions. Turn left, turn right, and do this, and then they say click, and here come 25, 30 feet down, and then they open up.
But what about that first time you went up in a plane and jumped out of a plane? What did that feel like?
I didn't feel like, I mean, that was easy. After you got out of the jump and the whole thing opened, because you got a steady line, you throw the steady line, and then here we go. After you left the 90-some feet out of the airplane, the part that chute opens.
So you got the hang of it pretty quickly.
Oh, yeah. The first two jumps are kind of ski. After that, there's nothing to it.
So you make five practice jumps, and you earn your wings. What did that feel like when they pinned those on you?
There's something. Very happy to be get your wings. You can, like I said, there were 750-some guys, and we only had 11 qualify for that. That's in Fort Benning, Georgia.
So you got done with that, and the war's going on. What unit did they assign you with?
The 17th Airborne Division.
How did the other guys treat you? What was it like being around all those other paratroopers?
They're all very nice. They all help each other like they should. Mm-hmm. Yeah, even when you jump, they have to check you back if the paratrooper's right and all of that.
Did you feel like you built a trust with other guys, that you could depend on them if you were deployed somewhere?
Yeah, I think so. Help each other. We sleep. Sometimes you got your friend sleeping in the same hole, in the same. We had to dig a hole when you're in the front line, and he watches you for a couple of hours, and they rest, and then you watch him for another couple of hours. And we help each other.
You know, I've interviewed a lot of Mexican Americans who served in the war, and including a paratrooper in El Paso, and he was one who felt like there was some kind of prejudice that he encountered, that he was treated differently because he was Hispanic. Others have said, no, that I got treated just like anybody else. What was your experience?
They treated me very nice, no problem. And I was a barber. When we got overseas, the captain asked if anybody know how to cut hair. And some of the guys, his name is Lucas, he said, Julian Mazuka. And the captain said, who's Julian? That was right in front of him. I said, yeah. I said, I had no tools, sir. He said, don't worry, we'll get you some. Uh-huh. And he said, for now, you're going to be a company barber. And that's what I was doing, cut the hair of those guys.
What would you rather do, shear sheep or cut hair?
Well, cut hair by easy.
The other guys in your unit were all Caucasian or what?
There's only two Mexicans in there. Uh-huh. One is from Denver, Colorado. His name is Tony Garcia and myself. In my company, and quite a few in different companies.
So how much hair did you cut? I mean, how many haircuts you think you gave in the service?
I used to do 15, 18 a day, and then I quit, and I didn't supposed to charge. I said, no, that's whatever they want to give me, it's okay with me. Because I wasn't supposed to charge, that's supposed to do, was my duty. Yep. And some of the guys had a lot of money, threw 100, 200 francs. And the end of the day, I had 1,600 francs.
All satisfied customers, I'm sure, right?
Yeah, we had no choice.
But who cut your hair?
This other guy, Garcia, Tony Garcia. He was my helper. He liked to do that, too.
What was your incentive for joining the paratroopers? What made it worthwhile for you?
We got $50 more, I mean $100. And those days was $50 a month, and we used to get $100 a month. And what I like it, we don't have to put no KP, and we had it fast every day. As soon as 5 o'clock, we sign, we out, and we go and get back, we in, and that's it.
That made you jump a lot, right? You had to jump so often to keep the pay up, is that right?
Yeah.
Well, as you're going through all these trainings, and you're jumping out of airplanes, practicing all this, I'm sure you know that you're going to have to do it for real at some point. Were you starting to get anxious about when you would head overseas and what it would be like?
I wasn't anxious. I just do what I had to do. They tell me what to do.
Well, and in 1945, they would tell you you had to head overseas. And on March 24th of that year, you were part of the largest single-day, single-location airborne operation ever. We'll find out about Mr. Mazuka's role in Operation Varsity when we come back. Next month, Mr. Mazuka will be headed to Washington, D.C. with Central Valley Honor Flight. Thanks to so many of you who are stepping up with your support into businesses like the one I'm going to tell you about in a minute. Hometown Heroes will continue after this. Our World War II veterans deserve a chance to see their memorial in Washington, D.C., and you can help send them there simply by renting a car. Between now and the end of October, visit any Enterprise Rent-A-Car location from Bakersfield in the south to Tulare, Visalia, Hanford, Selma, Fresno, Madera, Merced, all the way north to Sacramento. Tell them you heard this ad on Hometown Heroes, and Enterprise will donate 10% of your rental to Central Valley Honor Flight. Restrictions may apply. I'm sure you're familiar with Enterprise, but do you know why the largest car rental company in the U.S. is called Enterprise? The company's founder, Jack Taylor, was a decorated F-6F Hellcat pilot in World War II, flying off the deck of the Big E, the aircraft carrier USS Enterprise. Maybe I should get him on the show sometime and he can tell us how he earned the Distinguished Flying Cross. In the meantime, choose Enterprise for your next rental. Tell him you heard this advertisement on Hometown Heroes, and you'll be helping to send our World War II veterans on one more tour with honor. They say a picture is worth a thousand words, but when it comes to making my mouth water, I don't need a thousand words, just two of them. Mongolian beef. Okay, two more. Ming's restaurant. And I guess if you want to know where to find it, I should give you two more. Los Banos. That's where I grew up, and I'm guessing Los Banos is somewhere you pass through every now and then. And if you drop in for the Mongolian beef, you might start calling it what I have for years. My favorite place to eat. Period. He may not look old enough for this to be true, but the owner, Paul Cito, has been working his magic in the kitchen there for 45 years now. It's all delicious. If you're a garlic fan, try the Baja shrimp and thank me later. But the Mongolian beef is absolutely unmatched. The flavor, incredible. The texture, tremendous. I can't do it justice with words. You just got to go taste it. One word of caution, do not go on Monday because Ming's is closed on Mondays. So pick another day, tell them I sent you, and let me know if your taste buds enjoy it as much as mine do. That's Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in lovely Los Banos, California.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, where with each visit, we remind you that no matter where your hometown is in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you, right down the street, maybe right even next door to you, men and women who have put their lives on the line for the sake of our freedom. If you've ever been a sheep herder, a wool grower, there's a good chance you've had some interactions with our guest today, 92-year-old Julian Mazuka of Lemoore. For me, the closest I've come is eating at John Madden's favorite restaurant, Wool Growers, in my hometown of Los Banos. But when you talk about growing wool with Mr. Mazuka, he knows about that. He spent most of his life in the sheep shearing business. For 2 years in the World War II era, he was cutting the hair of his fellow paratroopers instead. I want to take a brief moment to talk about Honor Flight right now. If you're listening in Kern County or the Central Coast, Honor Flight has been operating in your area for a couple years now. But Central Valley Honor Flight's inaugural trip with 75 World War II veterans will head to the World War II Memorial next month. Our guest today, Mr. Mazuka, is going to be on that charter flight. And he was with us this past week at the Golden Eagle Arena in Lemoore for a really special event. Had such a great time out there. Such a privilege to meet so many of you. Want to thank EECU, West Hills College, and Congressman David Valadeo for making it all possible. Farney Automotive Group was there to present a check for $10,000 to Central Valley Honor Flight. And we all watched the award-winning documentary, Honor Flight, One Last Mission. This is not an exaggeration. There was not a dry eye in the arena. You really need to see this movie. And the next chance is going to be October 7th at the Clovis Veterans Memorial District Theater. Congressman Devin Nunes will be among our special guests this time. I'll tell you more about it next week, but it was really special to be there in Lemoore with Mr. Mazuka and his beautiful family. So we're going to move on with some more of his story now. I'm curious, back in the States in June of 1944, did you guys hear about the fate of 13,000 paratroopers who dropped behind enemy lines in those early morning hours of D-Day? 42 of the C-47s carrying them were destroyed. Over 1,000 paratroopers confirmed killed in that operation. Many more wounded, even more than that, missing. So did you guys hear about all that?
They made a big mistake. They jumped in at night time. They lost quite a few. Some they got lost, and then from then on, we used to jump in the daytime, beginning daylight, because they made a big mistake. They lost quite a few.
And when you guys heard about that, did that have an impact on you? Did you feel like that's what we might be in store for? And when you guys heard about that, did that have an impact on you? Did you feel like that's what we might be in store for?
No, it had no impact at all.
So you grew up in Texas. You joined the service out of Arizona, came to California for training, all the way across to Georgia. You saw a lot of the country. But had you ever been on a ship before they shipped you out?
No, I've never been.
So what was that like? What do you remember about heading overseas?
Well, it was very nice. We went back the boat called L'Aquitania, the largest, biggest in England, got 13,000 troops. And we land in Laca Beach, Scotland. And then from there, we were on a train all the way to London. And to London, we crossed the channel again.
Did you get seasick at all on that journey?
I never got seasick.
How was the food?
Very good. We eat twice a day, but we were all right.
You had a birthday cruise, huh? You had your birthday on the ship?
Yeah. It was in January 28th.
What did they do for you? Did anybody know it was your birthday?
Nobody knew. Just myself.
Do you remember what you were thinking going overseas? Because here your family didn't want you to go. They wanted you to go to Mexico and avoid all this. And here you are heading overseas. What do you think you were thinking at the time?
I was young. I was thinking something about it. Just if something happened, it's going to happen. If it don't, that's it. That's the way that feels.
Did you get letters from home?
Oh, yeah. My folks are used to write it to them.
And you moved pretty quickly from Scotland into England, then across to France. And what did you find when you got there, where all that intense fighting had been months earlier?
Well, everything was destroyed when we went in France, especially when they crossed the channel. That town was completely demolished.
What was it like to see that? Because I imagine you'd never been anywhere where that was what was in front of you.
Kind of surprised me to see something like that. I mean, I didn't figure something like that. But
were you anticipating the first time that you would actually jump when it mattered, when this was an actual mission against the enemy? What do you remember about the build-up to that?
I know there was, we were going to jump, and we had to do the best I know. You know, but a week before jump, we studied everything. They briefed us everything. What canals and power lines and all of that, everything. And we know what we're supposed to do. As soon as we hit the ground, we know exactly what we're supposed to do. And like we jumped 10 minutes behind the 2nd Battalion. By the time we hit the ground, we're bullets going in all directions. Airplanes burning, houses burning, and that's a big mess.
Well, and I want to talk to you a lot more about that, but for people that aren't familiar with us, let's tell them what this is all about, because they maybe know that paratroopers jumped on D-Day. Maybe they know about Operation Market Garden in Holland, but this is Operation Varsity. What was Operation Varsity? Where were you guys going, and what were you trying to do?
When we jumped, we tried to go to Berlin. That's where you're supposed to go. It's just where we drove. I mean, we still hit the ground. We two divisions jumping in the same place, England's and Americans. The England went towards the Rhine, America, we went towards Berlin. And we put mountains on days on the front line before the Second Army take over.
Yeah, so you had over a month of frontline combat after parachuting in, but you guys took off from France. This was an absolutely massive effort. While the ground troops are hoping to cross the Rhine, you get dropped on the other side of the Rhine, behind enemy lines. And you landed near Wesel, Germany, determined to fight your way to Berlin. I know how to spell it, W-E-S-E-L, but where exactly is Wesel?
It's 25 miles the other side of the Rhine. And from then on, we go all the way to Berlin. And that highway, I mean, they call it Autobahn. Yeah. That's a big freeway going to Berlin. Some of the guys were on the left, some on the right, and we go straight up. Every day we march. We take a little town every day, one or two towns, and sometimes we burst places because we had a fire and happened that we happened to go that way, they burned the whole town. Quite a few towns we destroyed.
I know that most of your experience was on the ground, but I want to get this picture. I'm sure a lot of people are fascinated by how this all started. And I imagine it struck you, the magnitude of this, when you guys were taking off. How many different airplanes full of paratroopers were going? I mean, there must have been a lot of birds in the sky, so to speak.
There was.
Was it kind of awe-inspiring to see so many planes going up at the same time?
Surprised me to see something like that. And surprised me when the Second Army took over. Well, all day, they don't have to fight. They give us a rest. They take over, and the following day, Germany surrendered. So I don't think they had to fight a bullet. They go straight on.
You guys did all the work for them, I guess. But I did look up the statistics on Operation Varsity, and I want the folks at home to picture just how immense this was with all the C-47s and C-46s, one of which is at Castle Air Museum in Atwater now, by the way, the C-54s, the gliders, the fighter escorts. This airborne armada stretched 200 miles in the sky. And how about this? For the entire force to cross any given point on the ground took more than 2.5 hours. That's how many Allied troops were in the sky on March 24th, 1945. Tell me also, what was it like jumping out of that C-47 on this mission? So you guys get to where you're supposed to drop, and then it's time to actually do this, what you've practiced so many times and trained for. Do you remember that moment when you exited the airplane and how that all unfolded?
Oh, yeah. I remember very well, but that's what we're supposed to do. That's why we do it.
Were you nervous at all jumping out? Were you confident you'd get it right, that your chute would open, that you'd land in the right place? I mean, what were you thinking?
Well, I was thinking, I hope nobody hit me. That's what I was saying. I hope no bullet hit me. And luckily, nothing happened. Soon they hit the ground, and we're ready to go. And we started go where you're supposed to go.
And what all were you armed with?
M1.
You had an M1 rifle. Did you have any grenades? What else were you carrying?
We got some grenades and M1 ammunition. And we had a fruit for 3 or 4 days. K-rations, they call it K-ration. And that's all the blanket and the things in your back.
How soon did you encounter the enemy? How long did it take before you saw the enemy and they were shooting at you?
The sooner we hit the ground, we can see bullets coming in all directions, and the house is burning, and we're ready to go. You see somebody, it's an enemy, and we let it go. We let it have it. Ever since they moved, we shoot him.
Were you scared?
No.
Why not?
I don't know. I never get scared. I mean, I just hope it's not in, nobody hit me, and that's it. Yeah, I was very lucky that nothing happened, not even one scratch.
You said you weren't scared. And I guess maybe if you're going to be successful as a paratrooper, maybe you need to put that out of your mind. But where do you think that came from? What convinced you that you were going to be okay and you were going to make it through all this?
That's pretty hard to say. I don't know. I was young. I don't think nothing bad going to happen to me, but I was willing to take whatever they come.
Some guys tell me that they just didn't think anything could happen to them. You know, they knew they were tough. Or some guys say, you know, they had faith in God that carried them through, or they just didn't think about death. Any of those sound like what you were feeling?
I don't think about that. When your time comes, and that's it. I'm the hard believer. When the time comes, and that's it, no matter what.
How did it affect you the first time you saw one of your fellow paratroopers get killed in combat?
Well, I see quite a few. Yeah, especially my company commander. He's right close to me. Not very far from somebody shoot him right in the head. Down he went. 3 days after we jumped, we got some tanks come and help us. And we were supposed to be behind the tanks. And he got a little bit to the right. And they got hit. Then we lost quite a few.
Did that trouble you? Did that make you wonder if you were going to be next? Was it just painful?
They don't see. That's when the time come and that's it. Maybe that was helping me. I was afraid of nothing.
So would you say you kind of got numb to it?
Well, yeah, and I was a little bit crazy. You know, when they crossed the canal after 3 days, there was quite a few. There was a machine gun to the left, a machine gun to the right. And I got on top of the left and looked around. And the sergeant said, "Julian, get out of there. You're gonna get hit." I said, "They don't like Mexicans."
And it worked, I guess. You must have been right.
I've been right. By golly, that Tony Garcia, he's the one that chewed those two machines, one on the left and one on the right. He sneaked in, and boy, he hit it. He got a silver medal for that.
Silver Star for taking out those machine guns. Is that one of those things, sticking your head up like that? Is that one of those things you look back on now and say, what was I thinking?
Yeah, well, that's what I was thinking. I said, when the time comes, the time's coming. That's it. Don't worry. I don't worry about things.
Well, I'm glad your time didn't come right there, because you got a couple daughters and 5 grandkids and 5 great-grandkids who wouldn't be here if it did. When you think back about all that, is there one moment that you think was your closest call, the closest you came to when your time comes, your time comes?
I think so. I still believe in those things.
What was the closest call you had? What was the closest you came to being hit?
Well, when we crossed the canal, I was trying to get in a tree, and I guess they see me, and they was shooting. I could see the bullets hit the tree, and they was pretty close.
But nothing ever hit you? You never wounded at all?
Not even when they jump, and we got no scratch or nothing. Some of the guys got scratches and all of that, and broken legs and some of that, but I didn't have no problems at all.
So this is the spring of 1945, and the war in Europe ended in May of 1945. Did you guys have a sense that you were getting close to finishing this up, that you were about to defeat Germany?
But a couple of weeks after we jumped, they tried to give up. Sometimes we got as much as 500, 600, they wouldn't surrender. They come and say, that's it, they don't want no more fight.
So you guys would take them prisoner and get them somewhere?
The sergeant said, 3 volunteers, you go get them, so... We're going to bring it in. One America in the front, and one in the left, and one in the right, and one behind.
You just march them around like that. There was a situation where you personally captured 3 Germans?
Yeah, well, I wasn't even in the front line. Some of the guys were about a mile ahead of us in the front line. And we go by to the haystack. And when I went by to the haystack, I smelled something like a human beings. And I said, I smelled something here. And the guy said, yeah, somebody shot. You guys, I know, I smell something else. So when I kick the hay, he has 3 animals inside of that haystack.
Wow.
So when I hit the hay, and they started moving the legs, and the hay come.
So were you checking every haystack you saw after that, or what?
Not very many haystacks, and I happened to go in that one. And this was.
Well, and let me ask you about that. I don't know how many of you guys there were, but was that a situation where they were just hiding and hoping nobody found them? Or was that a situation where they had weapons and could have killed you if you didn't see them?
They had no weapons.
Yeah.
They tried to survive because we check everything and there's no weapons inside of us. I guess they throw their weapons or hide them someplace. So I don't know, but they're trying to.
Well, you know, another interesting question, I guess, to ask, and I've had different takes on this one, too, is how did you feel about the Germans, the guys that you were fighting, the guys that almost killed you a couple times? How did you feel about the enemy?
Yeah, like us, you know, when we in the front line and something happened, we use the same guys to pull the ones that got wounded. The same Germans, they helped to help, and we did the same to them. They got hit, they're in bad shape, we get them out and help them out.
You saw some of your medics help out wounded Germans?
Yeah, we do quite a few then. We get them out and they're in bad shape. They want to survive.
When did you find out that Germany surrendered, and what was that moment like?
I feel there was something big. We don't have to fight no more.
Did you guys celebrate a little bit?
The second army take over, we got quite a bit of relief. We don't have to be in the front line. The second army take over. And the following day, they surrendered, so they don't have to do very much.
Yeah. So you guys had already gone back for R&R or what?
Well, after we do that, they sent us to another camp. There was a little town they call Oberhaus in Stuttgart. And they had a German camp, a Russian camp. They all those prisoners, they got ahead of them in those camps. And they used to get up at nighttime and do quite a bit of damage. So we put from 6 to 6. They're supposed to be out after 6 o'clock. They had to be in the camp. And they were always doing, watching those things.
Did you hear at any point during this time about the concentration camps and about what the Germans had done to their political prisoners and the Jewish people?
I was in the camp. I see some they are in bad shape. Some already died and some was ready to be dying in pretty bad shape. I mean, not even one, quite a few.
When you saw that and realized what those people had been through, how did that affect you?
Well, it's pretty hard to see those poor guys dying and put in bad shape. They didn't have nothing. We try to help as much as we can, but I know they need help real bad.
A lot of people don't realize there were all kinds of camps in German-occupied territory. And after a little research, I believe the camp Mr. Mazuka is talking about was a coal mining camp in Sterkrade, just north of Oberhausen, where Russian and Allied prisoners were forced to work in those coal mines until the Germans were overrun. This isn't one of the concentration camps as we know them now, but still a place where the conditions were deplorable and the treatment of the prisoners beyond inhumane. Mr. Mazuka saw quite a bit in World War II, and his story isn't over just yet. We'll have the rest of Hometown Heroes right after this. The average age of the veterans on this program is pretty close to 90, so I've seen firsthand over the years the challenges of aging, and I've realized that everybody approaches them a little differently. For some, a friendly senior living community is the ideal option, but for many of us, there's no place like home. I don't have any ruby slippers for you, but I do have an idea. Call Jason Selzler at 317 Construction, recognized by the National Association of Home Builders as a certified age-in-place specialist. Instead of giving up the comforts of home, why not let 317 Construction make your home more comfortable by making it more accessible? Jason and his crew can widen doorways, install ramps for wheelchairs or scooters, reconfigure your counters for better access, modify your shower for safety, secure grab bars wherever you need them, whatever it takes to allow you and your family to keep making your memories in the place that holds so many of them, your home sweet home. Call 905-8490. That's 559-905-8490. If you are a World War II veteran and you have not been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., Honor Flight wants to take you there, free of charge. The sooner you submit an application, the sooner Honor Flight can get you to your memorial. In Kern County or the Central Coast, call Lily Marsh at 661-544-VETS. That's 661-544-VETS. Or go to honorflightkerncounty.org. For Fresno, Madera, Merced, Mariposa, Kings, or Tulare counties, check out CV Honor Flight, CV as in Central Valley, cvhonorflight.org, or call Al Perry at 559-970-9853. That's 559-970-9853. Maybe you're the son or daughter of a veteran and you'd like to go along as a guardian. There are applications for that too, and there are other ways you can help. Donations to Honor Flight are tax deductible. We all owe our freedom and liberty to the men and women who put their lives on the line for it. Let's all come together now behind Honor Flight and give our veterans one more tour with honor.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is a 92-year-old veteran of the 17th Airborne Division, the Golden Talons, who delivered their thunder from heaven in World War II. We've heard Julian Mazuka remember how his family in his native Texas urged him to cross the border into Mexico and avoid the draft. But he was determined to do the right thing, as he put it, and serve his country. In March of 1945, he jumped out of a C-47 over Germany as part of Operation Varsity. And 6 weeks of frontline combat later, the war in Europe was over. But it's not as if you got to come home right away or anything, is it?
Well, I was supposed to go to Japan. In July, they dissolved the 17th Division. In August, they transferred me to the 82nd. And then the 82nd sent me to Japan. And we was in, and we get the boat from Marseille. We're supposed to be in Panama Canal in 7 days, and we rest, I don't know, about a week, and then we go to Australia, and from Australia we're supposed to jump someplace in the Pacific. But 2 days before we come to Panama, Japan surrendered. So they turned around and came to Virginia, and I was here 3 days later. 4 days later, I was in the United States.
Well, I know it was a long time ago, but let me ask you about that, because here you've been through this war in Europe, and you've seen so many guys like you get killed, and you've come close enough yourself to find out that they expected you to go over to Japan and go fight another enemy. Was that something that was hard for you to swallow or no big deal?
We were very happy to. We already whipped Germany. We're going to whip Japan.
So then were you disappointed when you didn't even make it to the Panama Canal?
Disappointed because we didn't make it.
I'm sure at some point that disappointment turned to celebration, right?
Yeah, well, they did.
What did it feel like to be back in America after everything you'd been through?
Oh, there was something. especially when you get out of the boat and you see flags and a lot of saying that you can let your heart come to your mouth.
Made you emotional to see that.
Very excited.
And what about seeing your family again?
Well, that was nice too. When they see you and they know that nothing happened too.
You marched in some parades when you got home?
Well, yeah, we wasn't given 30 days furlough. And then I went back to San Pedro, they gave me another 30 days furlough. And then I went to Fort Bragg, North Carolina. That's where we stayed. And then when the 82nd came from Europe, we meet them in New York. And we marched in New York, we marched in Washington, D.C., we marched in Philadelphia.
What did you see in those places? What kind of reception did you guys receive?
Well, everybody treats very nice, very, very nice.
I've had a lot of guys tell me that America was different then, and that there was a unity in this country, that everybody believed in what you guys were doing, and you were all in it together. Did you feel something like that?
Well, I was very proud of what we do. I was feeling very proud of myself, and I'm very proud of what I've been doing.
And it sounds like they made you feel like they were pretty proud of you, too.
I think so.
When you think back on all of that now, everything that you endured, everything that you went through, being a paratrooper and a World War II veteran, what are you most proud of?
Well, I guess what I did, I was very proud of what I did. And it's something that nobody can take it away from you.
When you see other guys who are paratroopers, do you have a connection with them that you wouldn't have with anybody else?
Well, we used to have a reunion. We don't do that anymore. We used to have a reunion every year. We got two, one local and one national.
Let's talk about Honor Flight. You're going to be flying to Washington, D.C. next month. You're not going to try to jump out of that airplane with a parachute, are you?
I hope not.
What do you think you'll get out of that? Why does that seem like something you would like to do?
I don't know. It's something that I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, I don't know what are we supposed to do.
Well, you haven't been to the National World War II Memorial, have you?
No, I don't think so. I was in Washington 1 week before when we were in a parade, and I think I went to the White House.
You guys marched right up to the White House?
Oh, yeah.
President Truman come out and wave, or what?
Well, yeah, he was right in front of us.
That must have made you feel important.
I think so. Make you very proud.
Well, at that World War II memorial, there are some powerful Pacific quotes inscribed in granite. There's a Pacific pavilion on one side, an Atlantic pavilion on the other. There's a pillar for each state. So I know that California and probably your native Texas will be meaningful to you. Go see the wreaths by those state names. But the one thing that I hear the most from veterans about, and certainly what's been the most moving part of the memorial for me in all the visits I've had the privilege of making, the field of stars, 4,000 gold stars representing the 400,000 Americans who died while serving in World War II. Underneath the stars, it reads simply, "Here we mark the price of freedom." Yes, that freedom is costly.
Do you ever think about that? All the guys who died in World War II and the fact that you could have been one of them? And what do you think we need to remember about those 400,000?
So is there something you remember the rest of your life? Those guys that got killed and they didn't come home. And we think it was lucky one like me. Nothing happens.
So you're looking forward to that trip?
I think so, yeah.
You're 92. I know you're not planning on going anywhere other than Washington, D.C. And we expect to have you around for a while. But when you think about your children and your grandchildren and their children, what do you think people should remember about World War II and about the Americans who went over and fought for freedom, people like you? What should we remember about what you did?
Something we'd be very proud to do those things.
Do you feel like what you did was important?
I think so. Very important.
Did you ever have to deal with interesting weather conditions?
Oh, yeah. Sometimes it rained and rain or no rain, it don't matter.
You had, your clothes weren't warm enough, so you stole a German overcoat?
Yeah, the third day, there's two guys that got killed. We supposed to dig a hole. So what we did, we take those guys out of the hole and throw them out, and we used the same hole to stay night, because the enemy is brought up from here to that house, not very far from us.
So the enemy was real close, and you needed some place to sleep.
Beginning dark. And we had to dig a hole, and the hole is already dug. All I had to get those guys out of there. And then we got called after that around 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. We take it close off and we use the same code and we code it.
So first you move the dead Germans out of the hole so you can sleep there, and then you go take one of the dead Germans' coats to stay warm?
Yeah, that's right.
Whatever you have to do to survive, right?
Right.
You know, you didn't mention anything about 88s. Did you experience the infamous German artillery heading your way, those 88 millimeters?
We hear the noise when they come in. We hit the ground because, you know, shooting us, and you can hear the noise. And we had to hit the ground, and we were hoping nothing happened.
Would you do it all over again?
Well, I'm too old to do that, but if I have to, I do it once, I can do it twice.
You're going on this trip, and you have not one, but two sons-in-law going with you. What does that mean to you that both of your daughters' husbands are going to take you on this?
I'll be very proud and be happy to go with me. I know they're going to spend some money, but...
They must think you're pretty special.
For me, yeah, I say so. Yeah. Yeah, they asked me a long time ago if I want to go. I said, yeah, if they fill the papers, and I guess we qualify for that.
If you walk outside and you see the American flag flying, does that mean something to you?
Damn right. This is something to me.
What does it mean to you?
Well, it means something that we in a free country, and we fight to get us on our gun free.
Before I forget, I want to say thank you, Mr. Mazuka, for serving our country. Thank you for telling us a few of your experiences. And what's this I hear about you becoming the runner for your company, relaying messages?
I learned something, and especially to answer the telephone every night. We had to stay a couple of hours in the telephone, and all night long, checking all the companies. And all I had to do is when they called Company B, had this Company B. Are you okay? Yeah, we all right. And we hear the noise, whatever happened, all night long. When they come to Company B, well, that's my company. I had to answer that. And I learned quite a bit of things. I was kind of afraid because my English was very bad. But I asked the sergeant, I don't want to do that. He said, no, you do all right, Julian. You go ahead and stay there. And I'm glad I did. Yeah, because I was in company headquarters. I was with the captain most of the time.
If somebody came to you and said, you know, I want to be a paratrooper, do you think I'm cut out for it? What do you think it takes to make a paratrooper?
Yeah, a lot of nerves. A lot of nerves to me. Yeah, because that's kind of scary.
So you're a pretty gutsy guy, huh?
A lot of exercise. You have to be in pretty good shape, very good shape to be a paratrooper.
I know we're backing up chronologically a bit, but I wonder if people have heard this one before. You mentioned how hard it was to pass and how many did not get through that training, but how do you get disqualified when you're training to be a paratrooper? There's one thing that'll really blow it for you, right? What is that?
Well, when you're paratrooper, they had to put you out of airplane once or twice. They disqualify you.
Yeah, you have to jump out on your own. And it sure sounds like you did that pretty fearlessly. Julian Mazuka, can't wait to see the smile on his 92-year-old face when we welcome back that inaugural honor flight on Halloween. Thanks to his son-in-law, David Baca, for facilitating our interview. If you have a veteran you think I ought to talk to, send me an email, paul@hometownheroesradio.com. We can interact on Facebook, too. Just type in Hometown Heroes Radio. And remember, if you're anywhere near Clovis a week from Monday, the date is October 7th, Monday night, October 7th, we'll be showing the incredible Honor Flight documentary again and celebrating the Clovis Veterans Memorial District's great support of Central Valley Honor Flight. We're out of time on the program for today. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you, as I try to each week, that freedom is not free.